It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, public input is a key part of the decision-making process in local government. But our guest says sometimes too much involvement can distort opinion and get in the way of good projects. We'll talk about the pros and cons of citizen feedback. First, the number of licenses purchased for the state's deer hunting seasons over the last two decades has declined by 6%, according to state data and a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Hunting is a big revenue driver in the state, and the drop in licenses could have a ripple effect on Wisconsin conservation efforts. Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, how you doing?
Good. Well, what is this report telling us about sales of these deer hunting licenses over the last couple decades?
Yeah, so basically the state sold around 50,000 fewer deer licenses, and that was between 1999 to 2017, and that's according to a report out this week by the Wisconsin Policy Forum. And really, this kind of has been happening for a long time, this decline. There was a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel story last year that showed that, you know, last season we saw around 588,000 licenses sold during the deer season. But if you look at that historically, that was actually like the second lowest number of licenses sold since 1976 or something like that. So we're seeing a lot of people drop out of hunting, and that's due mainly to people aging out of the sport.
Right. So is it as well, people are aging out of the sport. This is a lot, in large part, a story about baby boomers, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, because they make up a large population of hunters who head out into the woods every year. And as they get older, they're just not going out anymore. And we're not recruiting enough people to take their place once they're out. I mean, although we have seen an increase in the number of women who are hunting over, like, since 2000, we've seen about a 32% increase in the number of women who are heading into the woods. Last year, I think it was 63,000 or so women that were hunting. But still, the decline with the number of men who are hunting, that growth in the number of women who are heading out to hunt in the woods is not making up for that.
Let's detour now into what this means for revenue. You pay money to get this deer license. What does the state do with that money?
So that money, all of those sales, goes into the Fish and Wildlife account, and that funds conservation work across the state, not just for, you know, animals that are hunted, but also for work on things like endangered species. So that has been declining as these license sales have gone down. I think it was in 2006, there was around $70 million or so, and that declined to by about $4 million by fiscal 2015. And basically, there's been a roughly $6 million a year gap between what is budgeted for the agency, the Wisconsin DNR, to spend on conservation work and what they actually are bringing in as far as license revenues. So they've been trying to make that up through other means.
You mentioned this was a Fish and Wildlife Fund, and that makes me think, well, you also buy fishing licenses. Do we have comparable data for what's happening with fishing license sales as compared to deer hunting sales in the state?
Yeah. So with fishing, you haven't seen as much of a decrease. You've seen an increase in the amount of fishing licenses that have been sold. I think it was, what, somewhere around 4%, just under that. But that still hasn't increased with the pace of the state's population growth. So we're just not seeing as many people hunting and fishing anymore, it seems. And a lot of that is due to urbanization. People are moving out of rural areas and into the cities, and, you know, people are looking to video games and other activities to spend their time on, and not so much hunting, fishing, or trapping.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter in Superior, looking at a long-term decline in the number of deer hunting licenses sold in the state, what that means for conservation funding, and efforts to maybe bring in a new generation of hunters. Now, let's look at both of those, I guess, solution sides of things. Danny, first of all, are people talking about, okay, well, if we've got this decline in hunting license sales, we have to look elsewhere for this conservation money?
Yeah, conservation groups have actually been pushing for the state to increase license fees. They made this push during the last budget process, where they asked lawmakers to increase the amount of funding, I think, by about $4 million. And that did not go through under the last budget or under this current budget. So, but this fall, I think it was 14 or 15 conservation groups across the state wrote a letter to lawmakers and Governor Walker and also candidate Tony Evers, who is now Governor-elect Evers, about increasing license fees. And they're proposing to do that by about $1.7 million.
This might be a political hard sell to, say, the state's hunting community. They might want to see that conservation funding, might not be so keen on seeing their license fees goes up. Is that maybe one of the reasons this hasn't passed so far?
Yeah, I think, you know, well, and just the Republican legislature and the Republican governor that we've had has been very, you know, hold the line on taxes and hold the line on fees. So I think that has been kind of a non-starter in a political sense. But, you know, there is a question of whether or not we raise fees and we can strike that balance between pricing people out of the sport. I do think that the license fees that we have right now are pretty affordable comparatively when you look at other states. But, you know, you have to keep that in mind and balance the value of the sport against what people are willing to pay in order to participate in it.
And the other, I guess, possible solution would be finding new hunters to replace the people who are aging out of hunting. You mentioned, more women, but that's not making up for the decline in the numbers overall. Are there efforts to recruit more young people, or I guess even bring people in from out of state to fill in the gap?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the state has a number of programs that they've been working on, like mentored hunts, and they've been doing programs like learned hunts, and also they are providing new opportunities. Like 4 years ago, they introduced crossbow hunting, and that's grown substantially since it was introduced. I think around that time, there was 44,000 licenses sold when they started that, and now it's grown. I think there's been like 20,000 more licenses sold as of last year. So they're hoping to recruit more, but still conservation groups are saying it's unlikely that recruitment alone would make up that gap, that we're probably going to have to look to other ways to make up that decline in license sales by either increasing fees or looking to other sources of revenue.
You talk to people with conservation groups, the DNR in reporting this story, and the Wisconsin Policy Forum had this report out. Are you seeing a sense of alarm and urgency here, or is this kind of a slow-moving problem that people think they can right slowly and gradually?
Well, I think people are very concerned about it, because if you look at this report that was released, it said that we've seen a decrease in about 21% of positions that are funded out of the Fish and Wildlife account, which is about 144 positions from 1999 to 2017. So that's a lot of people who just aren't working on conservation anymore. And I think people have just been concerned in general about whether or not we have the funding to be able to maintain the things that we value as far as our natural resources and conservation work in the state.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, reporter for WPR News. She's based in Superior. She joined us today to talk about the drop in the number of hunting licenses purchased by state residents and long-term impact the loss of that revenue could have on conservation efforts in the state. When a town, city, or county has a new project on the table, say a housing development or a new road system, there will probably be public meetings to give people a chance to weigh in. But do those meetings give officials an accurate picture of what their community wants and needs? Our next guest says that feedback on the local level is sometimes, often maybe, dominated by naysayers. Sometimes too much engagement can actually get in the way of forward-thinking policies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you go to public hearings or meetings in your community? Do you think the voices there are representative of your community? Have you ever gone to a meeting to support an idea as opposed to opposing it? Do you work on the other side of things, in city or county or local government of some sort? What do you see when you have public meetings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alan Ehrenhalt is a senior editor at Governing Magazine. His recent piece on this is called When Citizen Engagement Becomes Too Much. Alan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, you write that there's just generally kind of an assumption that, yeah, if a local government's going to do something, you should, ought to, in some cases legally have to, have public hearings, public meetings, right?
That's the universal assumption. Nobody wants to be seen as anti-public engagement, and I'm not actually. But I do make the point that simply calling a public meeting and watching who comes into the room and listening to them is not necessarily going to get you the balance of public opinion on a question. Public meetings tend to be, as this has been known since the 1950s, public meetings, if you don't work hard to affect the way they operate, they draw in people who are against things over and over again. And people who are for things or neutral, they're just not as likely to go to those public events. And that's a problem. I wrote about Austin, Texas, where they have spent 5 years on a new zoning code, and they have had dozens, if not hundreds, of public meetings. And they eventually had to just stop and say that we're not getting anywhere. And despite all this public engagement, we're back where we started from. And I think there's a lesson in that.
Yeah, let's dig into some of the issues you point out. One is who shows up, not just necessarily people who are against things, but also it might overrepresent people with time or resources. How can public meetings, I guess, misrepresent the demographics of a community?
I think in a fairly simple way. You call a public meeting, and you're going to get people, as you say, who have the time to go. Probably going to get a slightly more affluent group of people. That's just the way it turns out. And you get people who are angry about things. Not many people show up at a public meeting on any project just to say, I'm really feeling great about everything, and I want to say how... what a wonderful job you're all doing. I mean, there may be people like that. You don't run across many of them.
And you also, in that Austin example you gave a case of there were kind of two separate conflicting interests. In this case, we don't have to dig into the details, but people advocating for larger scale public housing and people like homeowners who didn't want larger buildings in their neighborhoods. And what started off as, you know, maybe just some advocates on each side, because it was a us versus them situation, in these public hearings, lines got drawn firmer and thicker than they had been when they started.
Yes, and after 5 years, people were angrier at each other than they had been in the beginning. And, you know, my research suggested in Austin, by 2017, there had been 4,000 public comments and 60 position papers submitted to the city council. So it became not only a chore to get through it, but an impossibility, and they eventually had to pull the plug.
Now, you also write that you don't want to go back to a situation where maybe one group of vested interests, whether that's developers or whoever's in a smoke-filled room, makes non-transparent public decisions. Right? Is there some kind of middle ground?
Well, public engagement doesn't have to simply be large-scale public meetings. You can take polls. Polls are sometimes helpful. Members of a city council can go knocking on doors and asking people what they think. That's not foolproof, but those two things suggest that there are other ways you can solicit public opinion other than calling meetings. And one thing I can tell you with a pretty good certainty is that no matter how many public meetings you hold on any issue, the people who end up on the losing side will say there wasn't enough and they weren't consulted, and the whole thing was railroaded. It turns out not to be true most of the time, but people who lose are going to blame it on what they see as lack of access, even if that's not the fact.
Talking to Alan Ehrenhalt, senior editor at Governing Magazine, about public input, public hearings in local decision-making, and how maybe sometimes too much public input can make it hard to actually get things done in the first place. We'll bring on a caller now. We have Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question for your guest today is, is concern regarding, the education or the actual knowledge of the people who are getting involved in voting. There are people who are now socialists and they have no idea what socialism is or the actual cost. Or another example is that they think they get free health care when in fact it's not free, or free college education.
Let's put that, thanks, Charlie, in the context of a local government decision, Alan, where, you've got the elected city council maybe and experts, consultants from without or people within the government system who know more about, say, traffic management than the public. So how do you, is that part of the problem, a non-experts weighing in on things like this?
I think that's sometimes a problem. My experience is that people who show up at these meetings do tend to have a reasonable level of knowledge about what's being planned, but they also often have an ideological axe to grind. I think that's a bigger, that's a bigger problem than ignorance, frankly, is the rigidity of people who like to spend their time going to public meetings.
Is there a different way to convene things and, I guess, start things earlier in the process with setting agendas, bringing together disparate groups to start hammering things out before a pro or con proposal comes to a public hearing?
I think that's right. When these things go wrong, often what you find is that the local government knew what it wanted to do, and then it started having meetings. And that's really not the right way to do it. You need to start at the beginning and using several techniques. Focus groups can be helpful. As I said a little earlier, public polls are useful, and old-fashioned door knocking. There are other ways to find out what the public wants, but to assume that if you just hire a hall and bring in 200 people in an evening meeting that you're going to get a fair sampling of public opinion, I think that's where these things tend to go wrong.
In your experience covering these issues, do you see communities doing it right, that where they have a level of transparency, they have a genuine interest in input from the community, and structured in a way that there isn't the naysayer's veto that just shoots everything down?
I think there are places that have done it right. I'm not sure which ones to signal or to single out, but I think Portland and Seattle have done a pretty good job of monitoring public opinion, although certainly not foolproof, and have done some pretty creative things in development in those cities in the last 10 or 20 years. But you're looking the other way, you think of something like the Big Dig in Boston, which everybody's heard of, which ended up costing, I don't know how many, $25 billion or something, and was supposed to take a few years, and it took a few decades, and at the end, they ended up with a pretty good project, actually, but people felt, who were on the losing side, felt that nobody was asking their opinion, and their opinion was sought time after time. It's just a common syndrome.
Let's bring on another caller now. Bill is with us in Osseo. Bill, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My question is, can we use social media or more of a online forum to get people's opinion without having them show up in person?
Bill, thanks. Alan, is there a way to use technology as you see it to garner, solicit these kind of opinions?
Yeah, I think social media is valuable here. It's not foolproof either, but it is a way of informing people so that when they do go to a meeting, they will know what the parameters are of what's being discussed. I think that's as much time as people spend on social media, it's probably an underused way of providing basic facts about something that a local government wants to do. I should ask your caller if the Norske Nook is still open in Osseo.
The Norske Nook is still open and delivering great desserts.
Fantastic, Bill, and I'll put it.
I don't mean to do a commercial, but I was there many, many years ago, and I really liked it.
I'll put in a plug. We'll be talking about pies on the morning show tomorrow at 6:30. Speaking of the Norske Nook, thanks for calling in, Bill. This is facetious a little bit, but can an amenity, when you convene a group, whether it's a focus group, whether it's a pie or, I know, childcare or something to make it more fun and festive, is there a way to set up engaging, fun public meetings that really bring people on board and maybe lowers the tension if there's an issue of conflict?
Well, a pie from the Norske Nook probably wouldn't be a bad idea, but not every local government is going to be able to do that. I think that they ought to pay some attention to the timing of these meetings. If they're all at the same time, if they're all at 8 o'clock at night, which is tends to be when they are, you are going to get people who can come at that hour. I mean, I think you need to spread that around, maybe have some during the day, some on weekends, so that you get a different cohort of people who are available at different times during the week. If it's sort of like when you start all the World Series games at 8:20 Eastern time, you're going to get people who are available to watch at that time. But you miss a lot of people, so obviously not a direct parallel, but I think that's one thing that can be done.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Alan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Alan Ehrenhalt is a senior editor at Governing Magazine. He's with us to talk about public feedback in local government and how sometimes it can hold communities back from making new ideas a reality. You can still share your thoughts. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. If you've experienced this as a engaged citizen yourself or as somebody who works as a local elected official or a local staff. Think about the place you live or maybe a place you visit a lot. Is it a good place to go for a walk? Do you feel safe there as a pedestrian? Is there anywhere to walk to? Walkability has emerged as a big trend in renting and real estate. The National Association of Realtors said last year that demand for walkable neighbors is increasing and it's changing the home selling industry. But a lot of cities and towns today are not very walkable. Our next guest says there are lots of ways to change that. Jeff Speck is a city planner and the head of the planning firm Speck & Associates. He recently wrote a how-to guide for making places more walkable. His new book is called Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Rob. I'd be happy to talk about Turkey if you'd rather.
Well, maybe, if we have time at the end, for sure.
Okay.
But you spend a lot of your book talking about how to make cities and other communities more walkable. You start off talking about why, and let's start there. Why is it in our benefit to have more walkable communities?
Well, it's interesting as a city planner and as someone who argued for making places more walkable for many years, and my mentors before me, for mostly from a planning perspective and all the planning reasons and design reasons why it made sense to make places better designed, and seeing people not really caring all that much. And then what happened was about 15 years ago, there were these three other groups, the epidemiologists, the environmentalists, and the economists, who were all arguing from their playbooks about why we should be making more walkable places and getting a lot more traction, a lot more attention. In very brief, the economics argument, There's a positive argument to be made about people, of course, paying more to be in more walkable places because they value them. They value them more. But the basic story of American development is that we, in 1970, we spent 10% of our income on transportation, and we just about doubled the number of roads in this country. And now we spend 20% of our income on transportation because we've tied ourselves to this extremely expensive way of getting around, which is, dragging the car with us everywhere we go. The environmental argument is simple and easy. The more we drive, the more we're contributing to climate change. And then the health argument, we have these doctors who are basically saying we need better planning because we've engineered out of existence the useful walk in our communities. And so people aren't getting the exercise they used to get. We have the first generation of kids in America who are expected to live shorter lives than their parents. And these doctors are saying it's because walking isn't something we do as a regular means of exercise every day just to get around. And there's a lot more depth to all those arguments, but those are three arguments that I highlight in my last book, which was called Walkable City. And since writing that, I've realized that there were two more, which are in this new book. And one is about community, and how we find that in walkable places, community forms a lot more. You know your neighbors better. You participate more in community activities. And of course, the less, the shorter your commute, the more you participate in clubs and sports and other things, pretty obviously. But the other is equity. And the story is kind of sad, but the people who are dying in car crashes the most, the people who are pedestrians who are being hit by cars the most, are definitely on the lower end of the spectrum. And people often talk about cycling, you know, even in a place like Madison, which is well known for its cycling, but they talk about cycling as being this elite thing, right, that's done by wealthier people. But in fact, the latest data shows that fully 39% of people who commute to work are from the lowest 25% of income earners. So there's a strong argument for improving your cycle network as well to support those who need more help.
When people think of city planning, they might think of a big city downtown, and that's part of your story. But you say we should be thinking about this in smaller communities and even suburban communities, areas we might think of as sprawl zones.
Well, the second to last of my 101 points in my book is don't give up on sprawl. And there's a lot to be said about how even the worst sprawl could be made a lot safer, or let's just say less deadly, by making the streets better designed than they currently are. But, you know, most Americans live near or in walking distance of some sort of town center or city center or Main Street or someplace where actually that walkable lifestyle is available to people who want to have it, if it's provided and if it's attainable. You know, I do most of my work in smaller cities, about the size of Madison or smaller, or bigger cities that aren't that well known for advanced, you know, planning. I work in Oklahoma City. I work in Davenport, Iowa. You know, I've worked near Madison. We could talk about that. But the, you know, these are the places where most Americans live. And if there's some little knuckle of what we call pre-war urbanism, if there's some part of your city which was built principally before the World Wars and has some traditional urbanism in it, a main street where the buildings are up against the sidewalk and not behind a parking lot, or, you know, smaller stores and not a Walmart, or at least away from the Walmart, then that's a place where you can, by reinforcing walkability, but also balancing the uses, by adding housing, which a lot of downtowns are doing, you can make a real 24/7 place where people actually have that urban lifestyle you might expect in a bigger city, in a smaller community. And frankly, a lot of people prefer that. You know, a lot of people don't want to be in the big city, but they want all the benefits of a you know, less car-dependent lifestyle.
Jeff Speck is with us. His new book is Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. A lot of your recommendations involve making walking feel and be safer. And a big part of it is speed kills. Talk about the difference between if cars are driving 25, 30, 40 miles an hour in a place where you want people walking.
It's a real, you know, geometric relationship that increases dramatically with speed. So a car going 35 miles an hour is about seven times as likely to kill you as a car going 25 miles an hour. And this is the cusp at which cars are driving, right, in your city and in your more downtown areas or your more potentially walkable areas. So the question is, what can you do to cause drivers to choose to go a speed which is safer and actually just choose to obey the speed limit? And the problem is that for years in our communities, the highway engineers were applying highway engineering techniques to our downtowns, to our main streets. And this is a shocker often to people who aren't in the business, but it's normal to engineer a street for about 10 miles an hour over the posted speed. And the idea is that it's forgiving, right? That if a driver goes too fast, they won't crash on it. But of course, what that technique does is it causes people to speed. So, you know, I was working on a project in Alabama, and we were trying to make nice, calm streets. And the county engineer who was in charge said, oh, but you can't have that tight little curve, or you can't have that narrow street, because we have to engineer it for 40 miles an hour. I said, oh, but the speed limit's 25. He goes, yeah, but that's the speed which you have to engineer it for. There's this complete misunderstanding about the way that environment influences behavior in street design, and fortunately that's being changed right now. But most communities have been built around this confusion. And all the things that that cause you to drive slower are the things that often the highway engineers mitigate against. So, of course, we want to have small blocks, lots of intersections. We want to have parallel parking, which slows cars down and protects the curb. We want to have two-way traffic and not one-way traffic. Street trees, which were once termed FHOs, fixed hazardous objects, have actually been determined to cause drivers to go more slowly when they're near the road. Narrower lanes, you know, there's lots of things that you can do to actually, and the Dutch did it about, you know, 15 years ago and caused the number of pedestrian deaths to drop like almost to zero by basically saying we're going to engineer an environment in which drivers make the choice to drive slower.
It seems like when we talk about pedestrian safety, it's all about managing the pedestrian, making sure they cross when they're supposed to cross, where they're supposed to cross, that kind of thing. It sounds like you're saying, no, we can design safety. We can build it into the driving side of the equation.
Well, thank you for saying that, because, I mean, there's also a ton of pedestrian blaming that happens, you know, and pedestrians being advised to wear bright clothing, you know, buckets by the side of the road in Salt Lake City where you take out a flag that you're supposed to wave as you cross the street so you won't be plowed down. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's done. You know, and then this whole campaign now against texting while walking, right? Which, of course, you know, I've walked into a lamppost once doing that, but the fact is that it's principally the driver's behavior and I would say the engineer's behavior that's leading to the dangerous circumstances in our communities. And what's frustrating is we know how to fix it, but it's a very uphill battle in many communities to get the local public works engineer to allow you to do that.
We're talking to Jeff Speck, author of the book Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you look around, how walkable is the place you live? Is being able to get out and walk to some place, any place, important to you? Is it something you look for when you're looking for a place to visit or a place to live? What changes would you want to see in your local neighborhood or town? And what questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. So we continue our conversation about how to make communities more walkable. Jeff Speck is with us. His new book is Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us how walkable your community is or isn't. What would you like to see change? What would you not like to see change based on what you've heard so far? Or do you have a question? Call in at 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Mary is with us in Stevens Point. Mary, hi.
Hi. I'm on the Common Council in Stevens Point, and we've got one urban planner on our Common Council and people who are highly educated about street design and bike ped issues. So we've done a lot. The county has a bike ped plan that the city adopted. Two of our residents wrote a TAP grant, so we've got a grant for restriping a large number of city streets. We have a bike ped committee now that reports to Common Council, and we're instituting a 4-to-3 lane conversion on one heavily traveled four-lane road. But I also want to tie this in with your previous guest. We've had a whole lot of very vocal community pushback against these efforts that make our streets better for everybody. Horrible social media comments, rage shown at city meetings, and it's been daunting. But we've got a supportive city staff, and the mayor is supportive of our efforts. So we're getting things done in Stevens Point. It's already flat, and now we're making it even better.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff, your thoughts on hearing what Mary had to say in Stevens Point?
Well, it's what we call the bike lash, you know, when you try to add bicycle facilities and other stuff to a community or otherwise make it safer. And, it, you know, people, in my experience, it's not that hard to get to improve the pedestrian experience. But when you try to take any part of a roadway and recommit it to cycling, that's when you really get into the, you know, the different political stripes and people showing their, sometimes their worst side. I had a very funny experience. I was wondering if I would tell this story, but this is a perfect setup, which is that the last time I was on the radio in Madison, I was called on to be an expert because someone was considering a 4-3 conversion, which the caller mentioned, on a street heading north out of the city. This is what's called the classic American road diet, where you take a 4-lane road, which is inherently very dangerous and also very inefficient because the fast lane is also the turning lane, and you turn it into a 3-lane road. There's been many dozens of these done around the U.S., and they improve safety dramatically, you know, with a center turn lane that's shared, and they do not reduce the capacity of the street for cars. They handle just as many cars after as before. And what you can do with that extra 10 or 11 feet you get by eliminating a lane is put in 2 bike lanes or add parking or do something else. In this case, they were adding bike lanes. And the experience of these streets is that, you know, they handle just as many cars as before. The merchants do just as well or usually better along the street. And I was asked to come on the air because a city councilor in Madison who also happened to own a restaurant on that street was the biggest opponent of the conversion. And so they asked me to opine on whether these 4-3 road diets worked. And I said, you know, I don't have an opinion. I have evidence. And I listed the evidence and I gave all the reasons that I just gave you and some more. And then they said, okay, and now for the counter opinion, let's speak to the city councilor. And he had hung up. He had just stormed away from the telephone because he didn't hear what he wanted to hear. But, you know, there's a number of kind of easy, quick fixes that you can do. And the caller mentioned restriping, you know, which is so much cheaper than rebuilding a street. Just reallocate the pavement that you have in a way that makes people drive more safely. And I'm always looking for those streets in a community that aren't congested, you know, that have too many lanes, more lanes than they need. And that's a great opportunity to convert asphalt from driving or speeding into parking or into cycling or maybe into a parklet that broadens the sidewalk so you can do sidewalk dining or something like that.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Lisa in Janesville. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I am just wondering, after having lived in England for a few years and enjoying being able to walk anywhere that I wanted to in a city that I lived in that was about 25,000 people, now coming back to the U.S., and I really miss that, I'm wondering if you have looked at any of the designs of the layouts of the cities, which I know were built many, many years ago, but incorporating some of those designs into any cities currently in the U.S.
Well, I haven't switched any of the driving to the other side of the street
to make
it more British, but I think that there's a number of things that, let me just start over. The things that make British cities safer than most American cities have nothing to do with the historic nature. If you're looking at, you know, older American cities versus British cities, if you're looking at newer American cities, you might as well compare them to places like Madison and Milwaukee or the older towns. The real distinction is new versus old. And what did the country do in the last 50 years? The difference between the U.S. and England isn't principally that they're older, but that their last 50 years of road design has been much more pedestrian and cycling oriented and much less automotive oriented. Simply around, for example, how wide the driving lanes are, which sounds like getting in the weeds, but it's super important because the lane width determines how fast people drive. You know, how narrow the right of way is, whether there are street trees, and honestly, they haven't had the same destruction of their city centers from big box stores in England that we've had in the U.S. That's had a huge impact on the walkability of our smaller towns. They've had some, but not as much. So it's really not the historic nature of England that makes it a more walkable place. It's the mistakes that we've made over the past 50 years.
Lisa, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Jeff Speck. His new book is Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. We heard from Chris in Horicon. Chris says he's a truck driver. He's worried about narrowing streets when he's delivering into these maybe more walkable pedestrian areas. The narrow streets, he says, make his job more difficult and unsafe. Is there a loss there for making streets narrower when businesses need these deliveries coming in?
Well, you need to make sure that the streets, and particularly the intersections, are designed so that the trucks that are using them can maneuver, unless it's the wrong truck. And there are some places where you need to put in rules about truck size. But in most of America, you know, it's pretty large trucks. And you need to make sure they can maneuver. But actually, with due respect to Chris, I would say that the things that he thinks make his job more dangerous are actually causing him and everyone else to drive the proper speed. And tightening his roadway in a way that his truck still fits, but fits at 20 miles an hour and not comfortably at 30, is exactly what we need to do to make us safer while we make his job slightly harder. And that's a sacrifice I would ask him to make.
We've been focusing on safety. Let's talk about desirability and attractiveness. You have some suggestions. Some of your rules are things like, you got a parking garage, don't have it fronting right up on the sidewalk, because who wants to walk block after block of parking garage? What sorts of things can we think about to make walking attractive?
So the word I use isn't attractive, because that kind of implies a certain subjective angle.
Sure.
But I just say interesting. So people will only walk if the walk is useful, safe, comfortable, and interesting. Useful has to do with having different uses around you, so you're just not in a single-use subdivision, right? Safe, we talked about. Comfortable and interesting have to do with shaping street spaces so that they hold you nicely. We talk about outdoor living rooms when you're a planner, so having good edges and good spaces. But then, are those spaces interesting? Do they show signs of human habitation or human presence? Or are they boring? Are they blank walls? Are they parking decks? That sort of thing. Now, if you go around the U.S., certain communities have rules, for example, about building a parking deck. Do you have to put retail on the ground floor of that parking deck and give it a higher ceiling so the retail works if you're in a retail area? That's a rule some cities have. Or a more versatile rule, do you have to set the parking deck back at least 20 feet from the sidewalk edge and then build something like housing between it and the street? And more cities, I wouldn't be surprised if it's happened in Madison, more and more cities like that I work in, like Des Moines, have one or several examples of massive parking decks that you can't even see from the sidewalk because there's a thin liner of residential building between it and the curb. And you can kind of judge a city by whether it has these, you know, if a city's of significant size and it doesn't have these rules, then it's not focused on the attractiveness of its public realm.
We haven't even really touched zoning, and we won't have time for that, I guess, Jeff. But as
good.
We wrap
zoning's
up,
very boring.
Well, but important. But as we wrap up, are people, you mentioned different stakeholders are now getting on board with this. Are people, as you go from city to city, more and more buying what you're selling about walkability?
I've been doing this for about 20, 25 years, and I've seen a very dramatic change in what was originally a minority opinion. And now I think most people want what we are advocating for, but you know there are a lot of people whose feeling about a downtown or whose relationship to their downtown is to zip in and zip out, and they don't really set foot on it while they're there. Maybe they drive through it to get somewhere else, and they're always, you know, if their focus is their own self-interest, they're always going to want driving speed more than they're going to want, you know, a great place. And we always say, you know, you have a choice. You can be a place that's easy to get through, or a place that's worth arriving at. And one would hope that even the suburbanites among us would care enough about having a center worth admiring to make a little bit of a sacrifice in their vehicle speed to gain that benefit.
It's a good place to leave it. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thanks for listening.
That's Jeff Speck, a city planner with Speck & Associates. He was with us to talk about his latest book. It's called Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. Still time for you to share your thoughts about walkability in your community. You can do that on Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Can you walk around where you live? What would it take to get you out and walking in your community? There are new developments in an international incident that started 2 years ago between the nations of Iceland and Canada over pizza toppings. We've talked about this a little bit before. It all started when Iceland's president, Gudni Johannesson, made disparaging comments about pineapples on pizza and joked that he might ban the topping in Iceland. This offended Canada's honor because, for some reason, Ontario is the birthplace of Hawaiian pizza. In an interview this week with CBC's As It Happens, Iceland's president said he had gone too far, but he hasn't exactly become a pineapple pizza fan.
I have nothing against pineapples, but when they're put on a pizza, they get all sort of mushy. And I have 5 children, and I've been with them on school trips and so on and so forth. And the undeniable fact is that more often than not, when you have Hawaiian pizza, the pineapples are taken off and left, whereas the rest of the pizza is consumed.
He did clarify that he has neither the desire nor the authority to actually ban a pizza topping in Iceland. And speaking of ban, I'm seeing news today that there's a pizza trend in Sweden, a pizza with curry powder and banana. Yes, a curry banana pizza. It's another international incident waiting to happen. Diplomats, prepare yourselves. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.